The end of June was a busy time for the U.S. Supreme Court. In a 5-4 ruling along ideological lines, the High Court upheld Oklahoma's lethal injection protocol, despite some of the most heated arguments in recent memory.
The justices were so fiercely at each other's throats.
That's NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Today on Oklahoma Voices, we'll hear her thoughts on the 2015 term that concluded 2 weeks ago today.
Some of the justices said Oklahoma's expert witness had been inaccurate and had demonstrable mistakes.
The Supreme Court also struck down same-sex marriage bans in all 50 states, but it's still unclear how that will affect several of Oklahoma's sovereign Native American tribes.
Tribes aren't subject to any of the provisions of the Bill of Rights. The power that they exercise is inherent to them.
That's all coming up after this hour's news from NPR. This is Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hardzinski. The end of June was a busy few days for both the state and federal judiciary, but a lot of the reasons behind that began years ago. On April 29, 2014, the Oklahoma Department of Corrections executed Clayton Lockett. He writhed and moaned on the gurney and took 43 minutes to die, despite several attempts to insert an intravenous line. After the troubled procedure, future executions were halted, and more than a dozen death row inmates sued, arguing Oklahoma's three-drug cocktail violated the U.S. Constitution's Eighth Amendment prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. At issue was the sedative midazolam. The inmates argued it couldn't effectively produce a deep, coma-like state required for them not to feel pain while the other two drugs were administered. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where it was argued on April 29th of 2015, exactly a year to the day after Lockett's death. 2 months later, in a 5-4 ruling, the court upheld Oklahoma's procedures, but dissenting opinions still raise serious, broader questions about the death penalty. Here to talk about that with KGOU's Kate Carlton Greer is Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent who's covered the Supreme Court for more than 40 years.
I've actually never been at a Supreme Court argument like that before, and I've been to hundreds of arguments. I've never been at an argument where the justices were so fiercely at each other's throats through the questions they were asking of counsel. It was very clear that the most conservative members of the court, that is, Justices Alito and Scalia, and presumably Justice Thomas, too, although he doesn't speak at oral arguments these days, that they were very much of the view that if there was a problem with the use of this drug, it was only because opponents of the death penalty, or abolitionists, as Justice Scalia called them, had made other more suitable drugs unavailable in their view. And contrarily, some of the justices who didn't agree with them on this point said that in very heated ways that Oklahoma's expert witness had been inaccurate and had been proven inaccurate in his testimony, and that he'd made mistakes that were demonstrable mistakes, not questions of opinion, but mistakes. And these were not reconcilable differences, and it was a 5-4 decision ultimately that went in favor of Oklahoma and the use of this drug called midazolam. It was almost as heated in the courtroom when opinions were announced as it was during the oral argument. But you expect that sometimes when opinions are announced, and less so at the point of oral argument.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about the opinions because they were deeply personal. Also, broader than I was expecting here. Justice Breyer even questioned the death penalty as a whole. How frequently do you see justices spell out their ideological views?
Well, I would not say that these were simply ideological views. These are real views of the death penalty and whether or not it is cruel and unusual punishment. And three, probably four members of the court, maybe even five members of the court, although Justice Kennedy is a little more in the middle. But Justice Alito wrote the opinion for the court that said there has to be a way of doing these executions. The death penalty was there at the time that the framers wrote the Constitution. They did not consider it cruel and unusual punishment at the time, and therefore, basically, it's not cruel and unusual punishment today. On the other side were four justices, the liberal members of the court, the more liberal members of the court, all four of whom said, this drug does not meet the criterion of avoiding unnecessarily cruel and unusual punishment because it is not a drug that clearly prevents people from feeling pain. It's a sedative. It's not an anesthetic. It's not like the anesthesia you get on the operating table. And just because somebody is out cold doesn't mean that he or she isn't feeling very great pain. And they cited the, you know, some of the botched executions, including one in Oklahoma. And then there was a separate opinion written by Justice Breyer for himself and Justice Ginsburg that said, we've been on the court a very long time. We have upheld the death penalty, but we think it's now time to examine whether the death penalty itself constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Constitution, not just the drugs used to carry it out, but the penalty itself is cruel and unusual punishment because innocent people are being executed. He pointed to one case in particular where a guy was totally exonerated after 30 years in prison, a man who had at one point been labeled by, I think, Justice Scalia as the poster child for why the death penalty is necessary because he'd committed such a terrible crime, and then it turned out he hadn't committed it. So innocence was one of the points that Breyer was making, and the other is the rarity of the death penalty and the fact that the only people executed tend to be the most poor, the least represented, and that because there are such problems with the death penalty and how it is sought by prosecutors in some parts of the country but not in other parts of the country, or in some counties and not in other counties, or in some towns and not in other towns, it is an inherently unfair system. And it takes so long to actually impose the death penalty because of all the difficulties with it, sometimes as many as 20 or 30 years, that it doesn't even do what it's supposed to do. And remember, I'm speaking in the voice of Justice Breyer here. What it's supposed to do is be a deterrent, and it can't be a deterrent if it happens that long after the event. So he said, in essence, you either get a quick death penalty, which has a high degree of unreliability, or you get a long-term death penalty, which doesn't do what it's supposed to do, that is, be a deterrent. So he gives this long, I think it's a 40-page opinion, and he gave a quite long summary of it in court. And then I saw something I don't ever recall having seen before, which was Justice Scalia rebutting one of the dissents. And he did it sort of, you know, without having a written thing that he was going to read. He began by saying, you know, a few days ago, a majority of this court defied the voters by legalizing same-sex marriage, and now some members of this court would do the same thing with the death penalty, and went on from there. But he clearly wasn't reading in the beginning. He was speaking off the cuff.
Well, that's really interesting, and you touched on timing a little bit. I want to ask you more about that because oral arguments take place, and then months later, the decisions roll out. The Midazolam case, the opinion didn't come out until the very last day of the term. How do the justices decide when they will release these opinions?
If my recollection serves me, it was that argument was the last day of oral argument of the term in late April, and that is not an unusual period of time to wait for a decision. I mean, typically, Supreme Court decisions, unless they're just incredibly inconsequential and unanimous, they take at least 3 months to write and then hear from people whether or not the members of the court will join, and then they argue over language, and then the dissenters write something, and then there is a response to the dissent in the majority opinion, and some people may not agree with all the reasoning in the majority opinion but are willing to join part of the majority opinion. It's a very complicated and long, drawn-out intellectual process to say what the law is, and so that the lower courts hopefully will understand what the law is, and it takes a long time. It can take way more than 3 months. It can take, in this case, I guess it took 2 months. I think the average, and here I'm searching my memory, the average this term was about 3 months. And there are cases that take way more than that. They may take 6 or 7 months.
Do they try to save the bigger cases for the end of the term? That's always what it feels like. Or is that just the process of making sure they get it right?
Well, no, they don't try to save them till the end of the term, and I can point you to a couple of examples of that. For example, Citizens United, the Supreme Court decision that struck down most of the campaign finance laws, or a goodly chunk of the campaign finance laws in this country, and did away with legal understandings of nearly a century, that was actually handed down in the middle of January in 2010. A lot of it depends on when it's argued. In a lot of this term, a lot of the most important cases were argued late in the term. And you just forget how often important cases are handed down in the middle of the term, in January or December or February or March. They do happen. It's just that at the end of the term, there's this sort of train wreck of everything important that's left and a lot that's not that important. And it has to get out by the end of June. And there's a lot that comes down very fast. And so it feels like, oh, gee, they're saving them. They have a policy. The minute something is ready, it gets announced.
I know we're running out of time. I do have one more quick question, and I know we aren't fortune tellers, but do you have any predictions for next year's term? Any big cases that you expect to see?
We already know that there's going to be a major question of one person, one vote, and how you assess who counts as a person who, for purposes of redistricting, whether it's everybody of voting age or is it everybody only citizens and not those who are both legal and illegal immigrants. There's probably going to be a big abortion case revisiting what kinds of restrictions states can put on abortion. There's going to be a big challenge to labor unions that could pretty much gut their power in the public sector. We're going to revisit affirmative action and higher education again. So while this term, the liberals won 19 of the 26 major close ideological cases, the kinds of cases that the court has on the docket for next term would suggest that the reverse is likely to be true.
Nina Totenberg is a legal affairs correspondent for NPR. Nina, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
It was my pleasure, too. Thanks so much.
That was Nina Totenberg, NPR's legal affairs correspondent, talking about the 2015 Supreme Court term that ended 2 weeks ago today. In what was probably the most widely publicized opinion of the session, the court ruled bans on same-sex marriage were unconstitutional, effectively legalizing it in all 50 states. But there are parts of the country where certain federal laws don't necessarily apply, namely sovereign Native American tribes. KGOU's Kate Carlton Greer discussed the implications for the state's 39 federally recognized tribes with Lindsay Robertson. He's the faculty director of the Center for the Study of American Indian Law and Policy and the Chickasaw Nation Native American Law Chair at the University of Oklahoma.
The Supreme Court's decision was based on the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. So in consequence, it applies to all of the state governments which have been performing marriages historically since the birth of the Republic. The tribes are actually not affected directly by the decision because they're outside of the constitutional infrastructure.
Well, that relationship between the tribes and the states is pretty unique, right?
The way that the relationship, the constitutional relationship between the tribes and the federal government and the states is structured is built on an 1896 Supreme Court decision called Talton versus Mays. In Talton versus Mays, one Cherokee citizen was accused of having murdered another Cherokee citizen. The Cherokee Nation prosecuted the alleged murderer. His defense wasn't, I didn't do it. His defense was that the grand jury that indicted him was too small. And the Supreme Court said, actually, that's not how it works. The grand jury size requirement under U.S. law traces to the Bill of Rights, which is the first 8 amendments to the Constitution. And the tribes aren't subject to, at least in Talton, it was the specific grand jury clause of the Bill of Rights. But by extension, courts have held since then, tribes aren't subject to any of the provisions of the Bill of Rights. They're separate sovereigns. The power that they exercise is inherent to them as separate sovereigns.
Before we get to the same-sex marriage issue, we have to take a step back a while, actually, starting with something called the Indian Civil Rights Act. Tell me about that.
The Indian Civil Rights Act was passed in part in reaction to Talton versus Mays about a century later. In 1968, Congress passed this statute applying to tribal governments many of the same limitations that apply to the federal government and state governments under the Constitution. In 1978, the Supreme Court heard a case called Santa Clara Pueblo versus Martinez.
This is what I wanted to talk to you about.
Yeah. So that case involved Mrs. Martinez, who is a citizen of the Santa Clara Pueblo, who wanted access to healthcare facilities for kids who weren't citizens of the Pueblo, because under the Pueblo's membership rules, your dad had to be a citizen and not just your mom. And she believed that that was a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Indian Civil Rights Act. The Supreme Court decided at the end of the day they couldn't hear this case because the Indian Civil Rights Act, though it created rights, didn't create a right of an individual to sue in federal court for the violation of a federal statute. What individuals are supposed to do, the Supreme Court said, is bring Indian Civil Rights Act claims in tribal court.
So that would be the recourse that would be available, because this pretty much set a precedent that if it has anything to do with the Indian Civil Rights Act, the Supreme Court will not hear it.
The federal courts can take it if it's a habeas corpus petition, but otherwise it's for the tribal courts to adjudicate. So on the same-sex marriage debate, I think what the court would say is if you're an individual tribal citizen and you want to marry somebody who's of the same sex and the tribe won't marry you, you can't argue that they're obligated to under the Equal Protection Clause of the U.S. Constitution as recently interpreted by the Supreme Court, because that doesn't apply to the tribe.
So what could you do?
You could file a lawsuit in tribal court arguing that the tribe, by denying you the right to marry somebody of your sex, had violated the Equal Protection Clause of the Indian Civil Rights Act.
Could that have been an argument before the Supreme Court case ruling as well?
No, it could have been before the Supreme Court ruling as well. The fact of the Supreme Court ruling will probably make it more likely that people will bring these claims in tribal court, because there's sort of a momentum now. And the Supreme Court decision, while not binding authority for the tribes, because, again, they're not bound by the Constitution, may prove to be what we call persuasive authority, which is to say, if a tribal court wants to interpret or believes that the Equal Protection Clause language in the Indian Civil Rights Act means the same thing as the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, then they could simply say, and here's what that means according to the current Supreme Court, so we're going to apply that interpretation of the statute and we'll have the same result.
I wonder what would keep an LGBT tribal member from just going to the Oklahoma County Courthouse and getting a marriage license?
If the tribal members don't live in their Indian country, then that would be the thing to do. It would be to, you know, the normal thing to do to go to your county.
But it wouldn't necessarily be recognized in your tribal nation.
Well, that's actually a very interesting question. Here's why I hesitate, because the tribes are not a part of the full faith and credit regime.
Explain what that is.
According to, so the U.S. Constitution requires that the courts of one state recognize the decisions of other states. It's a way to keep the union together as sort of a judicial infrastructure, so that if you win a judgment in one state's court, you can enforce it in another state's court. Tribes aren't a part of that, according to most courts. So to the extent that recognition of marriage is something required under the Full Faith and Credit Clause, tribes aren't required to participate in that, and so it would be discretionary for the tribes. But this is an area we don't really have a whole lot of resolution on.
It sounds like maybe the Supreme Court ruling will force tribes to take a tougher look.
Well, I think it almost has to. The issue is now squarely in front of every government. And so tribal governments are incentivized to go ahead and be proactive and take a look and figure out what they want to do. And at the same time, LGBT community members inside Indian country are now incentivized to become even more activist than they have been.
You mentioned momentum. You think we'll see this kind of pick up in the next few weeks or months?
I think there will certainly be a lot more conversation about it than there has been.
The Cherokee Nation and the Navajos neither one allow same-sex marriage. Do you see if one of them could take a step, if that might encourage other nations, or do you think they act pretty independently?
I think they act pretty independently. There are certain tribes with historical affinities who sort of act in concert sometime, but we'll just have to see. I mean, I think this is going to be extraordinarily complex as a political and social matter within tribes that are still wrestling with this issue. And we'll just have to see how it plays out.
That was Lindsay Robertson, the Chickasaw Nation Native American Law Chair at the University of Oklahoma, speaking to KGOU's Kate Carlton Greer about the implications for the U.S. Supreme Court's same-sex marriage ruling on sovereign Native American tribes. You're listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. I'm Brian Hardzinski. The end of June was also busy for the state Supreme Court. They've been looking at the Ten Commandments monument on the grounds of the state capitol. It was erected in 2012 and paid for with private funds, but the state's highest court ruled the monument is illegal under the Oklahoma Constitution because it's on state property. That prompted Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to request a rehearing, and some Republican lawmakers have called for the impeachment of the seven justices who ruled against the monument. Legislative efforts are now underway to amend the portion of the state constitution that bars state funding for religious purposes, and as KGOU's Jacob McClelland explains, it's uncertain whether or not the monument would violate the federal constitution's First Amendment Establishment Clause.
At question here is Article 2, Section 5 of the Oklahoma Constitution, which states that public money and property won't be used to support any particular religion or be used to the benefit of any religious authority. In its 7-2 ruling, the Oklahoma Supreme Court ruled the Ten Commandments monument violated that provision. Republican State Representative John Paul Jordan filed a resolution to create a ballot referendum to remove that part of the Constitution. It has to pass a supermajority in both the House and Senate and then go to the ballot in November 2016. Jordan says a Ten Commandments monument like this, in a public space, does not mean the government is picking one religion over others.
At times what it is seen as is that government is reflecting the ideals and principles of the people that that government represents.
I'm going to be up front here and say we're going to talk a lot about previous U.S. Supreme Court cases over the next few minutes. That's because if the state constitution is amended, the monument's fate could be decided by the nation's highest court. Michael O'Shea is a law professor at Oklahoma City University.
The problem is the cases seem to be so fact-intensive, and, you know, details matter.
It comes down to whether or not a Ten Commandments monument is used in a historical or religious context. A pair of 2005 U.S. Supreme Court cases show just how difficult it can be to predict what could happen. In a 5-4 decision, the justices found Ten Commandment images in Kentucky courthouses to be unconstitutional because they weren't well integrated with other historical documents. At the same time, a Ten Commandments monument erected in 1961 at the Texas Capitol was found constitutional. That monument was among many historical markers and was deemed to have historical value. The justices also voted 5-4 in that decision.
Justice Stephen Breyer's vote in that case made the difference, and his concurrence, frankly, seemed to go out of its way to emphasize how impossible he thinks it is to reduce this area of constitutional law to a defined test, and it has to be a fact-based judgment that turns on all the circumstances.
There's also the 2009 Pleasant Grove versus Sumum case. The High Court found that governments can exercise free speech by choosing to place some privately donated monuments while denying others. That's why Representative Jordan isn't concerned that other groups which want to erect monuments, like a Hindu organization and a satanic temple, will succeed in putting their statues on the state capitol grounds.
They have to find someone in the legislature to author the bill to have it placed. They have to receive a majority in both the House and the Senate, and then it has to be signed by the governor. No, I don't see that being a concern, aside from we now have, you know, the procedure set in place for other monuments.
American Civil Liberties Union of Oklahoma legal director Brady Henderson says there are issues at play here with the state's wait-and-see approach to removing the monument. He says it's perfectly legal for the Ten Commandments to remain on the grounds until the state Supreme Court decides whether or not to rehear the case. Governor Fallon's request to wait until voters have a chance to amend the Constitution is a different matter altogether. Henderson says the state can't avoid a court order by saying they hope the law will eventually change in their favor. He compares it to going before a judge on a marijuana possession charge.
Would it work for them to tell the judge, "Judge, I know it's illegal to have marijuana here in Oklahoma right now, but you know, those laws are changing nationally, and probably someday it'll be legal here in Oklahoma, so why don't we just not have me sentenced? Let's just let me off the hook because I think the law's going to change." So, no, you know, you enforce law as it is, not as you want it to be a year or two from now.
Henderson says the provision that legislators like Jordan want to repeal is over 100 years old and part of the original state constitution. He calls it one of the state's strongest protections of religious liberty.
It says the government doesn't get to discriminate between your religion or mine or anybody else's. We shouldn't repeal that lightly because some of us are mad about one court decision. You know, you don't roll back fundamental parts of your law in a quick and dirty fashion.
Getting back into hypotheticals, if the provision is repealed and the case goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, Henderson says it's anybody's guess which way the justices will decide. For KGOU, I'm Jacob McCullough.
You've been listening to Oklahoma Voices on KGOU. This half hour, we've been looking at several judicial issues that have affected this state over the past month. The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of KGOU's staff and management or our licensee, the University of Oklahoma. You can find this program online at kgou.org. Coming up next is an audio rebroadcast of yesterday's episode of OETA's Oklahoma Forum that also breaks down the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in 2015. I'm Brian Hardzinski, and you've been listening to Oklahoma Voices.